compels me.
What the fuck's the matter with these cunts? What's the matter with them? That must be on some fucking mega ego trip, these guys.
We got horses and bloody ducks.
The whole part of being a rock star is being a rock star. And what's the rock stars do? You get a limo, you get a Learjet, you got people running around licking your ass.
I get nicknamed Nibby.
I looked at Bill Ward and he had this big long beard. And I said, you look like a pen nit. A stone.
Hello, I'm Azubis.
Very strange, and Geezer in particular had all sorts of weird dreams and weird thoughts. And it might have been the acid, I don't know.
Hey, welcome to Sabbath Bloody Sabbath. Welcome to Sabbath Bloody Podcast. I knew I was going to fuck that up. Today we're covering Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, the album. It's bloody everything today. I'm excited to get into this one. Anyway, welcome to the show. Hope you're all doing well out there. Show's been going well. I've been really busy lately, so it's hard to kind of squeak this one in. It might be a little shorter today, but I got a lot to talk about because this is a great album. It's definitely worthy of some attention. And it doesn't get as much love as some of the other Sabbath albums. Actually, I find people are more... like Volume 4 was the big cult thing, and it's kind of like almost like a Stone Cold classic now at this point. But it used to be kind of cult. It used to be the first three albums, and people wouldn't touch Volume 4 on. But Volume 4 kind of became cult. And then this one kind of got skipped over, and people talk about Sabotage a lot now being an underrated classic. But this one is the best of both those worlds, I think. It definitely leads into the more kind of proggy rock that they do on Sabotage, but picks up on some of that garagey kind of, you know, just riffage that Volume 4 was just chock full of. It also does some of the softer shit that we've started to. I got a quote here from Geese speaking specifically about the lyrics. So he says, "The lyrics to Sabbath Bloody Sabbath were about the Sabbath experience, the ups and downs, the good times, the bad times, the ripoffs, the business side of it all. Bog blast all of you," was directed at the critics, to the record business in general, the lawyers, the accountants, management, everyone who was trying to cash in on us. It was a backs to the wall rant at everyone. And you know that part. I mean, I sign off every show with it, the bog blast all you. Pretty scathing themes for the title track and the lead off track. And eventually the lead-off single as well. But I love the title, Sabbath Bloody Sabbath. It just screams old-school horror film poster to me, which makes sense because they actually got the title from a 70s movie, Sunday Bloody Sunday. They combined that with a headline from a review of the band that read, "Bloody Hell, Bloody Sabbath." That would have been a good title for a greatest hits package right there. Bloody Hell, it's Bloody Sabbath. Anyway, they fused them together and boom, Sabbath Bloody Sabbath. And combined with the album's artwork, done by the great Drew Struzan, of course, the guy who did all the Star Wars posters and the Indiana Jones series, most importantly to us classic rock junkies like myself, he did Alice Cooper's Welcome to My Nightmare, that Clockwork Orange-esque cover. Really badass. I used to have a poster of that. But the Sabbath Bloody Sabbath package is the best. Of course, on the front, you have a man in a big-ass satanic bed kind of getting dragged into hell by a swarm of half-naked devil chicks and... doesn't get any better than that, right? A big 666 on the headboard of the bed. And it's really cool, kind of like fire and brimstone color palette. I've also heard the painting was actually titled The Rape of Christ. So there's some more heavy shit for you. It's actually two paintings paired together. On the reverse of the LP, you got the opposite theme-wise. It's the same man, I'm assuming a Christ figure based on the title, in a cool blue bedside setting being comforted by angels and his loved ones. So heaven and hell, right there, you know, long before Dio. And so I've got a reissue of it. It's got the gatefold version of the album. And inside the gatefold, there's this killer tripped out photo of the four lads with the shirts off, kind of double exposure, with a bedroom in the background. And I've never heard what bedroom this is, but maybe it's the Stradella Mansion? I don't know. Or maybe it could be the Clearwell Castle, which we'll get to in a second, where they stayed when they recorded this album. It looks somewhat modern, though. Either way, it's like this acid tripped out sort of Doors looking photo on the gatefold. Ozzy's doing his best Jim Morrison kind of pout there. Awesome picture, very 70s and washed out in kind of like a ghostly tone. Adds to the atmosphere of the whole album. Oh, and the band's logo treatment on this one. That's something that actually got them in a bit of trouble. There's a very Nazi SS type font creeping in. But that just became kind of a metal font there after. In fact, this predated Priest, Motorhead, and Kiss even, I think. I know they all gotten some shit for their Nazi-esque imagery on their covers. Anyway, Sabbath did it first, like everything else in metal. But fuck, the font just looks cool to me. It's not like they had any like full-on swastikas. It's just kind of gothic looking. I don't see the big deal. But nevertheless, they did get in trouble for it. I get that people were touchy even in the 70s. That shit was still a little fresh, but it wasn't in bad taste. And it's a badass cover. The font doesn't look like it's trying to look like the cover of Mein Kampf or something. Let's get on to the lovely Caravan again, filling the gaps tour-wise.
It is a funny story. I think those stories are kind of best in the Caravan.
Okay, so last installment, we got through the Master of Reality tour, ending with the gig that never was for Sabbath, the Mar Weiss Soul Pop Festival in Puerto Rico. So that was April 3rd. And they didn't hit the deck again until July. So after they finished the recording sessions for Volume 4. Oh, one more thing of note. A few tracks from Volume 4 did debut live at the tail end of the Master Tour. Tomorrow's Dream and Snowblind make it into the set pretty regularly, as early as March of 1972. So before they even get in the studio on those ones. Actually, here's a set list from Winterland in San Francisco, March 10th. It's a killer Master era set list here. Just wanted to show you how early they were working on those Volume 4 tracks. You got NIB, Tomorrow's Dream, War Pigs, Sweet Leaf, Iron Man, Snowblind, Wicked World, guitar solo followed by Orchid, and drum solo. Well, they play Orchid, but they don't go into Lord of this World. Come on. And then they have Embryo, followed by Children of the Grave, Paranoid, and they close with Fairies Wear Boots. So that's what's going on the stage back then. But as we covered in detail last installment, the real debauchery was all offstage. And that continues, too, through the Volume 4 tour. Lots of nose candy. The lads are right into that designer drug scene with some supermodel groupies. But their shows were also becoming notorious for pulling in the trippers, the acid heads, and the full-on junkies, even. I'm sure the supermodels hadn't heard anything past the Paranoid single and were just hanging around for the nose candy at the Bel Air mansions. The live shows were still pretty scummy, though. Ozzy mentioned after the show, on the floor, there was like thousands of empty syringes. So some Hand of Doom action going on right at the gigs. The trippy scene was actually in full effect in the mid-70s, a breath after the Vietnam War, so you had a lot of that moody shit going on. And Sabbath were a big part of that soundtrack. Critics would routinely refer to Sabbath as downer music. That, combined with the gothy witch cult hang-ons, hoping for them to get back to their evil blues roots, Sabbath still had a big kind of underground feel. Even though they were high on the charts, they were still pulling in a pretty interesting cross-section of the world at their gigs. The next gig I want to highlight here is September 15th, 1972. So before the actual release of Volume 4, they play a typical early Volume 4 set list. Nothing out of the ordinary, but things got very heavy on stage that night during the closing number, which is Paranoid, of course. So apparently, Tony's gear had been acting up the whole night. So after they finished the set, he went over to kick over his cab, as you do. But before he could go full Pete Townsend on it, well, here, I have a blurb from Tony's book recounting the incident in detail. As I walked off the stage, there was this guy behind me. I never saw him, but he apparently had a big dagger. He was about to stab me. He got past security and was dressed all in black. It turned out he was one of these Satanist or religious freaks or whatever he was, and he was about to bloody stab me, and I'd never even seen him. I walked off the stage, and they jumped on him, and he was on the floor. I got back into the dressing room afterwards, and they said, "Fucking hell." And I went, "What?" I did feel uncomfortable about it, but I think in them days I was doing so many drugs that I didn't notice. "Oh, somebody went to stab me? Oh, bloody hell. Well, give us another line." He's got humor about it, but that's some scary shit, man. You know, like, that could have been a dime situation in the making, so fuck. Around this time, too, I touched on the last episode, apparently Tony was really feeling it. Not only was he under attack by Satanists at every turn, but he also had collapsed after the big Hollywood Bowl gig that they did, forcing Sabbath to cancel the last two dates of the first American leg, and ultimately of 1972, which included a trip over to Hawaii. So obviously, if he was that knackered, they're not going to make that flight. So they take a month off, or two, and resume tour in the new year. So in January of 73, they go down under for several dates in Australia and New Zealand. And then from the beginning of February right up to, March 18th, so a month and a bit, they tour Europe. starting in Germany, making their way back to the UK via Italy and France and Belgium. You know the drill. The important thing that happens during the leg of this tour is this is when we get the first official live recording. Well, it's set to be their first official live LP. Patrick Meehan organizing that for them. They record their gigs in Manchester and London. Ultimately, the live LP gets shelved, and it takes a long-ass time for these recordings to actually surface again, almost 10 years after. I don't think I'll ever do a full episode on Live at Last, so I'll cover it a bit here. It's a great track listing, actually. Not the hottest recording, and that's why Tony prevented it from being released at the time. But it sounds good now that it's been remastered in modern technology. And it's cool as hell to hear them live in this era. The height of Party Town here, Cokesville. But here's the track list for Live at Last, recorded over two nights. It's actually quite an incredible performance, and you should check it out. It's up on YouTube, of course, or try to find it on vinyl. I've seen it pop up a few times at record fairs. So side one, you got Tomorrow's Dream, Sweet Leaf, Killing Yourself to Live, which we're playing now, Cornucopia, Snowblind, then Embryo into Children of the Grave. Embryo's not listed on the back of the sleeve, but it's there. It's a fucking great version of it, too. So then side two opens with War Pigs. And then there's this big, huge, medley jam kind of thing that contains Into the Void, Supernauts in there. There's a drum solo. And it's kind of bookended by Wicked World. But it all kind of just rolls together, which is pretty cool. They also play some little, like, bluesy jam in there. I don't know what it is, but it must be some cover. Anyway, they, of course, close with Paranoid. So that really closes out Caravan today. So the band, when deciding to cut a new album, set up camp again at the same Bel Air mansion where they did Volume 4, calling in the same groupies and same drug dealers, I imagine, that made their stay there so bloody inspiring. Unlike previous Sabbath albums, most of which had been recorded on the run between tours and such, this time, Tony decided he wanted to take some time. Instead of simply going in with jams, they would step back, take the time to consider what they had and how they could improve upon it. And he perhaps gets a little too much in his head for this record, Tony, that is. Here's a quote from him from Mick Wall's interviews from the book Symptom of the Universe, which I still haven't picked up, but here's a quote from it. We thought we'd go back to LA and get in the same studio, do everything the same, get the house and rehearse there and write. And of course we did, but we couldn't think of anything and nothing happened. We just dried up. Nothing was happening. It all fell to pieces for us and we were all despondent. And apparently the studio had been revamped by Stevie Wonder a few weeks earlier, so the whole feng shui of the joint was fucked up. Tony got fed up pretty quickly with the magic being gone. He actually went all emo at this point, got his hair cut, and even shaved off his trademark mustache, which is fucking shocking, man. If you see pictures from 73, dark times, man. By the time June rolled around, Tony had enough of LA. He ordered the band back to England, where they would take a break in order to try and reestablish some sense of normality before beginning again. And that's when Sabbath decided to go back to their roots, bring back some evil shit. Gone was the poolside LA party, and they settled on Clearwell Castle, an 18th century neo-gothic-esque deep in the forest of Dean. Shit's getting medieval here. Clearwell Castle became a temporary home for a number of high-profile artists, like Bad Company, Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin. They all spent some time in there while recording some albums. But ever the trendsetters in heavy music, as I've mentioned, Black Sabbath were the first ones to properly rent out a castle. They were still pretty strung out and rehearsed and slept in the dungeon of the castle. Bringing back the spooky now, some debut album vibes. Apparently, they quickly found out that the castle was haunted by a mischievous female ghost who would enter locked rooms, leave them all a mess. She was also said to sing lullabies, all that typical bullshit, but the band, being the drugged up lads they are with their ghostly imaginations that we've established through the years so far, they all have separately claimed to have seen figures and long black cloaks and shit moving and paintings and stuff. Here, this is a bit from Ozzy's book here about their stay in Clearwell. We recorded the next Black Sabbath album in a haunted house, out in the middle of absolutely fucking nowhere. I don't know whose brilliant idea that was, but it wasn't mine, that's for sure. The name of the place was Clearwell Castle. It was in the forest of Dean on the Welsh border, and it scared the crap out of us from day one. It had a moat, a portcullis, I don't know what that is, four-poster beds in the rooms, big fireplaces everywhere, animal heads on the wall, and a big old dark musty dungeon, which we used as our rehearsal room. It had been built in 1728 on the site of an old Tudor manor house. And the locals told us that a headless figure would roam the corridors, moaning and wailing. We just laughed it off, but as soon as we unpacked our bags, we all started getting the willies big time. At least that took the pressure off us, as far as the next album was concerned. We were more worried about sleeping alone in those spooky old rooms with swords and armor on the wall than coming up with another million-selling LP. So there you go. They were also taking the piss out of each other, playing tricks, scaring the shit out of old Nibby, so much so that Bill used to sleep with a dagger under his pillow when crashing at the castle. Eventually, they don't stay overnight there anymore, but it does get the creative juices flowing, as I said.
Power of the Rift compels me!
Won't you listen?
Excited to get into this one today. Kicking it off with the title track here. This alone is a big reason why I love this album. The dynamics on this one swing far in the spectrum. You got that monster Iommi riff carrying some big time groove. Blew the goddamn mustache right off Tony Boy's face. And then there's this, an unexpected kind of sideways turn to a jazz-like part, but it works. Not yet, okay. But that jazzy part is kind of serving as the chorus, I suppose. It's hard sometimes with Sabbath to label the parts in traditional song structure sense. Especially on this album, because, you know, Tony, sometimes he'll kind of riff in a completely different key or even style. Just for a couple of bars and then wham, back into another riff entirely. Remember Cornucopia? I mean, they kind of continue in that vein on this one. Yeah. The Iommi riff well runs deep, and it's funny though, because leading into this album, it's widely reported that the well had apparently run dry for Tony, and that, I'll get to that in more detail, but this riff, after an exhausting touring schedule and backstage excess, Tony had nothing left in the tank until this one opened the floodgates again of riffage. So the theme of this one lyrically, at least what I devised from various interviews that I've heard, it's kind of a fuck you Sabbath naysayers. It's coming, this 73 OG breakdown. The drop, as you dubstep kids would call it. Hold on to your skull beanies, motherfuckers. God damn, it's so hard to pick one riff to rule them all on this album. But I'm going to save my Power of the Riff. Let's go to the second track now. This is my favorite song. You might recognize this if you're a Metallica fan too. Yeah, just fucking listen to this riff. Okay. Let's just give that one the flag. It's fucking badass.
Power of the Riff compels me!
For me, and I'm sure a lot of youngsters, I actually got into this album through Metallica after Garage Inc. and the amazing Sabra Cadabra cover that was on there. It also included this number, A National Acrobat. And Sabbath Bloody Sabbath quickly became a mainstay in my Discman. It was probably the first Black Sabbath that I picked up on CD. Actually, it was the only non-compilation CD that I picked up an official copy of. Like I said before, I was late to the CD game, and I was rocking tapes well into 1999, so I had Paranoid Master, We Sold Our Souls, I think even Volume 4 on tape, and I snagged this one on CD from my local pawn shop. Then I got the Symptom of the Universe comp in the early 2000s, and those were my only official Sabbath CDs that I had, so I played this one a lot in high school.
Then burnt CDs came in and MP3s, and I had the whole fucking shebang at my fingertips. But I still have a little CD collection boxed away somewhere in storage in Canada. I think this is in there, and the Symptom of the Universe CD box set is in there for sure. But now I'm a hipster. I'm all about the vinyl, man. So I got the Sanctuary reissue of this one in my crate now. I'd love to find an old school copy of this album too, just for the crack. But back to the 1-2 punch of Bloody and Acrobat. I've always loved that. It's very similar to Volume 4's Wheels and Tomorrow's Dream lead off. Both tracks are riff monsters that kind of snag together, showcase the tone of the album nicely. And lyrically, National Acrobat gets a little tripped out. Ozzy has said that it's about masturbating, written from the perspective of a sperm. I don't know if that's quite what Geezer was going for. When worlds collide, I'm trapped inside my embryonic cell. Doesn't sound like masturbating. That sounds like some conception. Sounds more like the sperm hitting the egg, right? Not into a tissue. Sorry. Getting graphic. Let's pull up the lyrics here, though. I'm in the world that hides the universal secret of all time. Destruction of the empty spaces is my one and only crime. I lived 1,000 times. I found out what it means to be believed. The thoughts and images, the unborn child that never was conceived. When little worlds collide, I'm trapped inside my embryonic cell, and flashing memories are cast into a never-ending well. The name that scorns the face, the child that never sees the cause of man, the deathly darkness that belies the fate of those who never ran. This is some fucking cool shit, man. I've never read it out like this. I don't know what kind of acid Geezer was on, but it worked. So from this great number, we get into an instrumental break on the album. I don't have much to say about this one, actually. The title explains the track, really. It's one of the weaker of Tony's instrumental interludes, in my opinion. But our riff lord Ben does a sweet little acoustic cover of it, even doubles up the tracks like he did on Laguna. So I'll just play this through for you. This is Fluff. Here's some stuff on Fluff while it plays behind me. Named after Alan Fluff Freeman, a BBC Radio 1 DJ in the 70s who regularly played Sabbath tracks on his program. Apparently it became a gimmick for his listeners to write in. No one called in back then. They'd write, "Dear Fluff, more Sabs, more ELP." So Tony wrote this sappy little jam for him as a tribute. Acoustic guitars augmented by piano and harpsichord. All Tony too, which is impressive. But this track's not really for me. I prefer Laguna Sunrise, that's for sure. The bridge is pretty cool, though. Ben nails it here, too. Let's go to that. Lovely, magical stuff on this one, right? But the real magic, though, comes with the next track, Sabracadabra. this goddamn southern fried riff for you. This is some fucking chicken picking. What's not to love about this one? Probably as bouncy a riff as it comes. Also, it's the most love song-like lyrics. That shouldn't work, right, with this mad riffing? Well, it fucking does. Actually, the lyrics on this one are based on the English voiceovers that the lads heard on some German porno films that they were watching. Here they are. Feel so good, I feel so fine. Love that little lady, always on my mind. She gives me loving every night and day. Never gonna leave her, never going away. Someone to love me. You know she makes me feel all right. I can't not sing this one, right? Someone who needs me, love me every single night. Feel so happy since I met that girl. When we're making love, it's something out of this world. Wow! Did fucking David Lee Roth just pull in for a verse? Feels so good to know that she's all mine. Gonna love that woman till the end of time. This is very fucking Van Halen, isn't it? Maybe they pulled their lyrics from German porn, too. For this track on the album, they also brought in the aforementioned Rick Wakeman of Yes, who was brought in to add some cheerful honky-tonk piano to this number. A little honky-tonk at parts and some epic synthesizer as well. I can't really say that I like what Wakeman brings to the table here. I love what his son does with Sabbath later on, around 13, and the tours steps in and does kind of Jeff Nichols kind of vibes. But Rick is a little too showy for my taste. But hey, like it's been said before, he was a close friend and fan of Sabbath. So old man Rick is solid in my books. And they even paid him in pints, apparently, which I respect. Only two bitters, so that's a fucking steal there for this track. All right, so that's side A of Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath. Burned down, as my man Clint from Metal Up Your Podcast would say. Let's flip the record to the very underrated side two. I love them all in here, though. Check out this riff. Cuts on Sabbath, 47, best deep cuts of Sabbath, killing yourself to live. This is one that they came up with on the road. They actually jammed this a bunch during the Volume 4 World Tour. Intro's a little bouncy. On the album version, there's some wacky instruments going on too. It all fucking works though. Killing yourself to live is amazing. A cautionary tale, possibly self-aware song about the rock and roll grind, man. Once the track gets going, it's pretty goddamn heavy too. Chorus call out might be their best. It comes in this part. Killing yourself to live. Awesome. I do love this track. If I was to make a list of great Sabbath deep cuts, this and the other one that comes later on this side, Looking for Today, would be the tops of that category, along with pretty much all of Never Say Die, because I love that fucking album. So let's look at these lyrics, shall we? Well, people look and people stare. Well, I don't think that I even care. You work your life away, and what do they give? You're only killing yourself to live. Killing yourself to live. So, some antisocial, paranoid-esque lyrics to start. Typical kind of Sabbath deal, I guess. Nothing too unique, but there's a big shift when they bring in the drugs full on later in a verse after Ozzy whispers in snowblind fashion, smoke it, get high. They set up another big tempo change in the song. The last part has some fucking crazy lyrics too over this psychobilly kind of riff. It's actually quite a bit of rockabilly vibes throughout Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, now that I think about it. So anyway, the lyrics seem very stream of consciousness at this point, playing off nursery rhymes and shit. These are the words. I don't know if I'm up or down, whether black is white or blue is brown. The colors of my world are all different somehow. Little boy blue is a big girl now. I dig this though. So you think it's me who's strange, but you've never had to make the change. You never trust any. You never give your trust away. You'll end up paying till your dying day. Rad stuff. Killing yourself to live. A live staple in my dream Sabbath set for sure. So the next one is actually a weaker number. No one likes this song really. I don't mind it though. It's very Aussie to me. And I love fucking Aussie, so I get off on it. But it's the bottom of the pile as far as riff power, that's for sure. Who are you? I don't even have anything to play for this because it's basically just Ozzy solo on the Mellotron. pretty fucking playing a simple. I know a lot of people hate this track, and I get it. It certainly doesn't stack up with the others on this album, but I still kind of dig the vibe that it gives. It sounds like it could be in fucking Stranger Things or some early 80s zombie flick. And Ozzy's vocals, again, are top notch on here. It's still kind of filler, really, as far as structure and such. It definitely has a vibe, though, which I like. So let's just skip over it, but let it be known that Rye kind of digs Who Are You. On to the next jammy jam. This is Looking For Today. Very similar dynamics to the title track. A big riff versus trippy jazz chorus parts in there too. There's even a goddamn flute solo in this one. Naomi busting out the Jethro Tull, Ron Burgundy shit at one point. I like that the lift comes in here at the bridge. I'll skip to that. It's a cool guitar part. Awesome. And Ozzy's vocals, like I say, fucking top notch on Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath. And they just continue to get better in Sabotage. He really fucking soars on Looking For Today. They're fucking raw and powerful. I'll say it one last time. Ozzy Osbourne, under fucking rated. Yeah, Dio's got power. Ian Gillan's a fucking monster too. Fucking Glenn Hughes is Glenn Hughes. He can do his fucking scales, I guess. But fucking, to write off Ozzy as a bad singer is to write off fucking rock and roll. Okay? Speaking of powerhouses, let's go to the big closer. The big sign-off today. This track, this is the Stairway to Heaven moment on the album for me. I fucking love this song. Spiral Architect. Can't stress enough how special this fucking track is. I want you to go listen to the album version because I can't do it justice here with the resources available to me. This is a symphonic masterpiece, and the drums are amazing, the bass is amazing, the vocals again. Ozzy's on fucking point, as I said. God knows what the fucking lyrics are about, but who cares? It's so fucking good. And they know that it is good. That line actually reminds me of Spinal Tap, rock and roll creation, right? And he looked and he saw that it was good. Let's take a look at these lyrics, actually. Guy's on another plane of writing on this one. Sorcerers of madness telling me their time. Child of God sitting in the sun, giving peace of mind. Fictional seduction on a black snow sky. Sadness kills the Superman, even fathers cry. And of all the things I value most of all, I look inside myself and I see my world and I know that it is good. You know that I should. Okay, this is just a fucking killer closer again for the album. So, go listen to Spiral Architect right now. Shit, go listen to this whole goddamn album. Could be my number one of all time if they didn't put out Master of Reality, that is.
Far the rift compels me.
All right now!
Actually, what I'll do here is I'll just list out the credits and the personnel here. Let me bring this up. You can see when instruments made the cut on the album. It's actually pretty interesting. So, Ozzy rocks the synthesizer on Who Are You, as I mentioned. He's also credited on Killing Yourself to Live. Synth part on there. Cool, I didn't know that. Then Hand Claps on Looking For Today. Everybody gets that credit. Tony, aside from the obvious guitar tracks that he ripped down, he plays piano on Fluff, Sabracadabra, and Who Are You. He plays the synths on Killing Yourself to Live and Who Are You. Harpsichord on Fluff. Organ and flute on Looking For Today, and the motherfucking bagpipes on Spiral. Shit. So, branching the fuck out, the wall of sound that is Tony. Good show, old man. Geezer plays synth and mellotron on Who Are You, and the nose flute on Spiral Architect. Is that just a cheeky Coke reference again? I think it might be. Old Nibby rocks some additional percussion on there. You got some bongos on the title track, Tippany on
Spiral and Who Are You? So, fucking all that, and you still have the addition of Wakeman's parts. He played piano and Minnie Moog on Sabra Cadabra, and as confirmed by Tony, additional keys on Who Are You? Although, just as they did on Volume 4, Sabbath credit themselves as producers. No Patrick Meehan this time. But we gotta talk a bit about Mike Butcher, who was behind the board as engineer, making it happen. This album is way better production-wise than Volume 4. And I'd even put it ahead of the first three albums with Roger Bain, sonically. So, good job to your man Butcher there. He didn't butcher it at all. Then, the big close with Will Malone conducting the Phantom Fiddlers on Spiral. All that, and yet this album doesn't feel crowded. So the mix was done really well. Again, we'll credit that to Butcher. All right, so that's Bloody Sabbath, man. That's the album. It's criminally underrated, in my opinion, man. This is an incredible album. It deserves to be talked about more. It's always Volume 4 and Sabotage, like I said, they get the call of love. This one, to me, is the best of both those albums. So let me know your tops and drops. Send them through Twitter. I'd love to interact some more with you supernauts. I know we stayed a little more focused on the tracks today because I don't have much time. Not as much tour stories and such, but the lads are more or less still living the life. And we'll get back into the managerial drama next month because that's what Sabotage is all about. Tony's mustache shave, that was the biggest change from Volume 4. That should be your takeaway. It's scary seeing pictures from 73. I should have spent more time on that, really. Anyway, thank you so much for everyone checking out the show. Don't forget to leave me a review on iTunes if you can. That really helps out. And shoot me some Twitter love at Sabbath Bloody Pod. I love hearing from you guys there and interacting with you. I try to get on there a little bit every day. All right, so I'm out of here, lads. Keep on, everyone. God knows as your dog knows. Bog blast all of you.